Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for July 10th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines, Valiant State, and USA Today headlines. Our first article is titled, Temperatures Soar to a Record-Breaking 118 Degrees, written by Haley Evans. Records are made to be broken. The temperature in Phoenix soared to 118 degrees, breaking the daily record for July 9th by 2 degrees and exceeding the normal by 11 degrees. The National Weather Service has issued extreme heat warnings for 11 counties across Arizona as much of the state swelters. Forecasters said there would be little relief overnight, with temperatures expected to remain above 90 degrees, and urged caution. This looks like it'll be the hottest day of the summer so far, said Matt Salerno, the lead meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Phoenix. Many places across the desert are going to see records being broken. The official weather station reached 118 degrees at 3:45 p.m., making it the hottest day of 2025, surpassing 117 degrees recorded at Sky Harbor International Airport on June 19th. This stretch of dangerous heat is fueled by a high-pressure system stalled over the region, and it's also keeping monsoon moisture and any subsequent relief at bay. June 15th marked the official start of Arizona's monsoon season, and the elements are mostly in place for a storm to develop. What's missing is enough moisture in the air to produce rain. We have this official season start of June 15th, said Michael Crimmins, climatologist at the University of Arizona. But the atmosphere doesn't know it's June 15th, other than the sun angle. Arizonans can't expect monsoon showers just because the calendar says it's time. Monsoon conditions typically build more slowly, and all signs suggest we've entered that window. But while the dew point is high enough, the moisture levels aren't. Climatologists look for rising dew point temperatures, a measure of the moisture in the air, to mark the start of the monsoon. In Phoenix, an average dew point temperature of 55 degrees maintained over 3 days signals a change in conditions. Phoenix saw its first monsoon activity last week. Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport recorded 0.16 inches of rain on July 2nd and up to an inch in parts of the West Valley. Higher terrains saw even more activity, and storms and wind gusts stirred up desert dust. While drought-stricken desert dwellers are always excited to see rain, it wasn't a dramatic start to the season. So when will it rain? What triggers a monsoon? And how could this season perform? Before Phoenix gets soaked, it gets scorched. Arizona is often dominated by a strong area of high pressure before the monsoon kicks in, sometimes called a subtropical ridge or monsoonal ridge. This high pressure system plays a major role in both blocking storms and driving extreme heat. That ridge is currently parked over Arizona, acting like a giant atmospheric lid, creating scorching daytime temperatures and warm nights beneath. The high pressure aloft is going to keep a lot of the monsoon activity at bay, said Salerno. Wednesday is going to be the worst of it. We're forecasting highs between 114 and 118 in the metro. That could be a record high, surpassing the current record for July 9th of 116 degrees. The record or near-record heat will continue until July 11th, when temperatures will hover closer to 110 degrees through the weekend. The slight dip will occur when the high-pressure system moves west toward California. There are no storms in the immediate forecast in Phoenix, preventing significant relief from the heat. There's going to be some thunderstorm activity surrounding the valley in the high country and along the Mogollon Rim and down in southeastern Arizona over the next few days, Salerno said. We just don't have enough moisture in central Arizona right now. Salerno predicts there could be thunderstorm activity next week, but chances remain 10% or less until then. Meteorologists previously used dew point averages to calculate the start of the monsoon, a better reflection of when sticky, storm-ready air actually arrives. The dew point would have to be at least 55 degrees for 3 days in a row to signal the monsoon arrived, or 54 degrees in Tucson. For public safety and awareness, consistency, and data collection, the National Weather Service began relying on June 15th as the official start date in 2008. But the atmosphere sticks to its own schedule. The big monsoon pattern we see at the upper levels of the atmosphere doesn't fully form until the first week of July, climatologically, Crimmins said. That's when a key shift usually occurs. High pressure settles over the Four Corners region, steering moisture northward from the Gulf of California and Mexico, helping storms develop across the state. Based on the old system, Phoenix's monsoon began on July 2nd, the first of 3 days with average dew point temperatures above 55 degrees. So far, the monsoon is unfolding on schedule. Crimmins said early signs, like warming sea surface temperatures and storm activity picking up in Mexico, are encouraging. Dew points are rising, hitting that 55-degree threshold across the state. The next big change will come when the ridge of high pressure finally moves into a better position toward the Four Corners. This opens the door for more widespread moisture and atmospheric activity needed to spark thunderstorms. None of the signs point toward drier than average conditions over the next 4 to 6 weeks, Crimmins said. The next article is titled, Clean Energy Sector's Future Murky After Law's Passage, written by Sasha Hupka. President Donald Trump's massive federal spending and tax law stands to have far-reaching impacts on Arizona's energy and clean technology landscape. The legislation, pushed through Congress last week by Republicans, could cripple the clean energy industry by sharply rolling back tax credits for solar and wind. It contains longer phase-outs for hydrocarbon, nuclear energy, and some other carbon-free forms of generation, but still reflects a seismic shift away from initiatives designed to support a national transition to renewable power. That's widely expected to have a plethora of downstream effects, many of which will be amplified in the desert. Early studies suggest that the legislation will hit Arizonans' pocketbooks. The state is experiencing rising energy demand, which is already expected to drive up electric rates in coming decades. But some experts say other factors, such as the price of natural gas and the success of initiatives that support nuclear generation, could help mitigate the expected cost increases. I would take it with a grain of salt, said John Godfrey, Senior Government Relations Director at the American Public Power Association. The new law also hits key advanced manufacturing sectors that employ thousands of people statewide. Officials had invested heavily in developing a clean technology hub in Arizona, but local solar companies and electric vehicle manufacturers are now left with an uncertain future. Those shifts could also impact battery and charging infrastructure supplies. In total, the state's economic development arm estimated the legislation could threaten tens of billions of dollars in potential investments and tens to thousands of future jobs. All in all, it's going to raise energy prices, kill jobs, and reduce economic growth, said Alice Neal of Verigy Solar and EV Solutions, a Phoenix-based company that builds clean energy infrastructure for its clients. And there you have it. It remains unclear how the changes might translate to utilities' sustainability goals. Power suppliers have plans in place to reduce carbon emissions, fight climate change, and meet growing energy needs by moving toward renewables in coming decades. Spokespeople for the state's two largest electric utilities, Arizona Public Service Company and Salt River Project, suggested their respective utilities remained committed to fixed energy portfolios to meet future power needs. Mike Phillipson of APS stressed that the company would continue to consider all types of energy generation projects through a competitive bid process as it seeks to meet growing demand. This process allows the market to determine the resources that are the most economical for our customers following passage of the legislation, he said in a statement. We're committed to thoroughly reviewing all future generation proposals through this process to ensure we continue to deliver reliable service at the most affordable price for our customers. Jennifer Schuricht of SRP said utility officials were still reviewing the law to determine whether it could impact planned projects and initiatives, but noted that its long-term planning roadmap called for a combination of natural gas, energy storage, and renewables. SRP is committed to serving its customers with reliable, affordable power while making progress towards its sustainability goals, she said in a statement. Experts largely believe utilities' public commitments will be difficult to immediately roll back, but leaders' long-term strategies for getting to the goals may shift. They've already begun the process of moving away from coal-fired generation, and that is unlikely to reverse. They could now choose to focus on different forms of renewable power or opt to lean more heavily on fossil fuels like natural gas, which produces less carbon than coal when burned, but still has major environmental impacts. Utility officials can still build solar and wind farms if there is public buy-in for such projects. But unless they move quickly, there won't be any tax credits available for them. Diane Brown, executive director of the Arizona Public Interest Research Group, said state officials may ultimately map the waters for utilities. They said there is momentum behind clean energy goals from businesses and residential power users, and noted that the industry has created jobs that politicians may be motivated to save. Policymakers often see and hear local impacts in a way that individuals in Washington, D.C. may not, and recognize the need to advance projects that have already been started, she said, adding that she hoped utilities stuck to existing clean energy goals. There's also the threat of continued whiplash. Utilities are highly regulated, and political headwinds could change with every election cycle. The fate of energy tax credits has ebbed and flowed over time, said Godfrey, the public power lobbyist. I don't know that this is the last chapter in the book. Various analyses show electric bills are poised to rise across the country, but the exact numbers are squishy. A report from Princeton University offers some of the most recent estimates. It predicts an average household's energy bills will increase by about $284 per year by 2035, although it notes that is an approximate figure given significant uncertainty about future outcomes. That represents an increase of more than 13%. Other groups, largely affiliated with the clean energy industry, had also forecast a wide range of future cost bumps. The numbers will almost certainly fluctuate by state. Brown said she expects that the legislation's impacts on electric bills could be amplified in Arizona. The analyses that we've seen from across the country tend to highlight the expected population growth and the growth of data centers as factors that may contribute to consumers here paying more than in many other places, she said. But much is still unknown about how utilities statewide may respond to the federal bill's passage. Godfrey said it contains some provisions that could mitigate how much customers end up paying. The legislation preserves longer phase-outs for credits bolstering nuclear, hydropower, and other projects. Godfrey and other lobbyists also fought to maintain a mechanism called elective payment, which allows public power utilities to directly receive and monetize energy tax credits for certain projects. That creates savings that can get passed down to consumers. There's such a huge amount that goes into what your total bill is, Godfrey said. Investor-owned utilities can't participate in that mechanism, but there may be other benefits for them in the legislation. The Edison Electrical Institute, a trade organization for power companies, noted in a policy briefing earlier this year that for-profit utilities had benefited from corporate tax reductions passed during Trump's first term. The new legislation extends those tax cuts, which were set to expire. The organization estimates that those costs resulted in nearly $62 billion being returned to customers nationwide. In a statement, CEO and President Drew Maloney said there were many provisions in the new law that will help utilities deliver affordable, reliable energy and grow our economy. The state's largest utilities have plans in place to increase power supply while pursuing a cleaner energy mix in coming decades. APS, which serves 1.4 million customers statewide, needs to increase its energy supply by close to 60% to meet demand in 2038. Its plan included dramatically upping solar and wind generation, as well as its battery storage capabilities. The utility aimed to transition its power mix to be entirely clean and carbon-free by 2050. SRP had similar goals. The nonprofit utility said it wanted to cut carbon emissions by 82% from 2005 levels over the next decade, and it hoped to reach net zero by 2050. Its roadmap called for investments in renewable power sources, as well as bringing about 2,000 megawatts of new natural gas online. U.S. Energy Information Administration data shows more than 50 generation projects in the works statewide. Of those, all but a handful are solar or battery storage projects. Nearly two dozen have yet to start construction, and six are scheduled to enter operation in 2028. If construction begins within the next year, those projects will be eligible to claim tax credits. Otherwise, the projects must be placed into service by the end of 2027 to qualify. That timeline may work well for smaller rural utilities, according to Godfrey. He said there's still good opportunity to develop small-scale solar projects that won't take years to complete, such as adding panels to a water treatment plant or carports. For larger utilities, though, the picture appears less clear. Godfrey said utilities will have to make adjustments, but what those changes will look like depends on a host of factors beyond just the new legislation. He expects reliability, available technology, and customer demand for certain types of energy could play a role. The price of wind and solar is declining substantially over time, and people are getting more vocal about what they want, he said, adding that customers are increasingly asking where their energy comes from. I think there's just a lot of variables to play out. Meanwhile, solar and wind companies were bracing for impact in the days leading up to the bill's passage. The legislation stands to gut residential solar in particular, an industry that was already facing significant headwinds. My company and I feel like we're going back to 2005, said Joy Seitz, CEO of American Solar and Roofing in Phoenix. We have to build it all back up again. Still, some saw the bill's passage as a potential turning point, a moment for the industry to reignite grassroots support and focus on making progress on the local level. It's just incredible that we're living in such a robust state with all of this economic development, and we're not doing things at the state level that we should be doing, said Neil Averagi, noting a lack of solar-friendly policies in Arizona. So I would say that we can do it here. If the federal government is not going to support it, then let's do it ourselves. It's not just the solar and wind industry raising red flags about the spending and tax bill. The legislation will also end tax credits for the purchase of electrical vehicles after September, drawing that industry's fire. The Zero Emission Transportation Association was among the lobbying groups that bashed the legislation last week. Executive Director Albert Gore, the son of the former vice president and climate activist, said in a statement that the new law does significant harm to the speed at which the domestic electric vehicle and battery companies can scale up capacity to compete on the global stage. It could spell trouble for a prominent sector in Arizona that is already facing headwinds from supply chain challenges, the threat of tariffs, and a tough auto market. Officials with Lucid Group, the state's most prominent electric vehicle manufacturer, declined to comment on what the legislation could mean for the company. But CEO Mark Winterhoff said in an interview with an industry publication leading up to the bill's passage that the tax credit issue would make it difficult for many budding electric vehicle companies to compete with industry juggernauts that have long benefited from the existing policies. The challenge comes as the company looks to dip into the mass market with a new vehicle late next year. The car, which the company has teased but not yet unveiled, is poised to come in with a price tag of about $50,000 and introduce the luxury manufacturer to a wider range of customers. Up to now, its cars have remained out of reach for most drivers. Those impacts may also trickle downstream to battery and charging infrastructure suppliers. Antoine Mestisco, head of strategy at Breathe EV, said his industry is facing similar downward pressure to solar power businesses. The company is a homegrown startup, the type of business that state leaders are increasingly focusing on cultivating as they seek to establish the desert as a major technology hub. We're concerned that jobs may be at risk or businesses may be in limbo regarding expansion, said Brown of the Public Interest Research Group. We hope that state policymakers will recognize the benefits these industries have brought to our state and work with them to figure out how they can continue to have successful operations here. The next article is entitled, Searchers Scour for More Than 170 Still Missing in Texas Flooding, written by Janine Santucci and Christopher Kahn. Hopes for finding some of the 170-plus missing people in the wake of devastating flooding along Texas's Guadalupe River were dwindling as officials in the hardest-hit county said they haven't rescued anyone alive since the day of the flood. The July 4th flash flooding claimed the lives of at least 119 people, a toll that has steadily risen as search and rescue teams and volunteers comb through debris. At least 27 of those deaths were children and counselors at Camp Mystic, a longtime girls' Christian camp that sits along the river. It, along with homes and campgrounds in the area, were inundated in the early morning hours of July 4th, with little time to act. The death toll increased July 9th in hard-hit Kerr County to 95, including 36 children. That's up from 87 the day before, Sheriff Larry Latitha said. At least 161 people are missing in Kerr County alone, Governor Greg Abbott told reporters on July 8th. There are still five campers and one counselor missing from Camp Mystic, officials said. The hearts of our fellow Texans are breaking every single day because of what people in this community and the surrounding area are going through, Abbott said. Drier weather is on the horizon for parts of central Texas, but scattered storms and showers, along with hot weather on July 9th, threatened to hamper search efforts, forecasters said. Temperatures feeling like the low 100s are anticipated in coming days, according to AccuWeather. Storm and shower activity should recede through the end of the week, though isolated activity could still spell danger, forecasters said. Abbott said an investigation into the events surrounding the tragedy may begin in an upcoming special session of the legislature, and he took umbrage at a question during a July 8th news conference about who's to blame for the heavy toll of the calamity in an area known for flash floods. That's the word choice of losers, Abbott said of the word blame, before launching into an analogy about the state's most beloved sport, football, and how different teams respond to hardships. The losing teams are the ones that try to point out who's to blame, he said. The championship teams are the ones that say, "Don't worry about that, man, we've got this. We're going to make sure that we go score again and we're going to win this game." Officials in Texas have for days defended against questions about who was monitoring worsening weather conditions and who was in charge of sending emergency alerts that might have prompted evacuations before the worst of the flooding hit. After a sunny day at Camp La Junta in Kerr County, 11-year-old Beau Brown was awakened early on July 4th and led outside by a counselor as floodwaters began to rise near the Guadalupe River. He and other campers climbed to higher ground and watched as counselors braved the torrent to rescue younger boys, some of whom were moved into rafters above their bunks before being carried or swum to safety. Thanks to the quick, independent actions of the camp staff, all 400 children and counselors were accounted for within hours. Parents credited the counselors with saving lives, praising their bravery and decisiveness. If it hadn't been for them, it would have been a very different scenario for our boys, said Beau's mother, Georgia Brown. They didn't have anyone telling them what to do. They just did it and saved a lot of our boys. You're listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled, May's Looking to Take Out Two Valley Smoke Shops. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays came out against the two Phoenix area smoke shops her office was suing, promising to run them out of business after she said they sold products to minors. The Attorney General said that despite multiple citations, thousands in fines and warnings, New York Smoke Shop LLC and ProSource are two of the businesses that most persistently and recklessly sell tobacco nicotine products to underage kids in Arizona. May's remarks were made during a July 8th news conference at her office on Central Avenue near McDowell Road. We're seeking to dissolve their companies, Mays said. This action is essentially the business version of the death penalty. So you do this, you are not going to exist in the state of Arizona anymore as a company. The two companies, Mays said, violated the Arizona Consumer Fraud Act. The companies exercised deceptive practices by repeatedly selling to underage consumers and vending colorful merchandise to draw in children, she said. Mays added that these companies push extreme sales and discounts to try to lure in younger customers. She used as an example a vape device she had on hand that she said was shaped like what she called a Hot Wheels toy car. They are actively drawing kids into their stores with cartoon-like advertising, graffiti, art styles, and colorful displays that are designed to attract children, Mays said. Smoke shops were investigated through Counter-Strike, an attorney general's office program where youth volunteers enter stores and try to purchase products illegal to them. The average rate of failure on these inspections was 13%, according to Mays. In these kinds of investigations, New York Smoke Shop has had an 83% failure rate in the past 3 years and has only passed one of six inspections done by the Attorney General's office, Mays said. ProSource had a 67% failure rate, according to Mays. The suit filed against both companies sought damages of upwards of $10,000 per violation, along with an injunction. New York Smoke Shop has locations on Ray Road and McClintock Drive in Phoenix and a location in Chandler. ProSource has locations in Glendale, Scottsdale, and Tempe. Neither company could be reached for comment as of July 8th. The next article is titled, Council Extends Homeless Shelters Service Contract. The charity that runs the region's largest hub for homeless shelters and resources in downtown Phoenix narrowly avoided a service disruption after ending a contract dispute with city leaders. In a unanimous vote on July 2nd, council members extended Keys to Change's service contract through June 2026. In doing so, they also attached a set of strings that they believe will improve communication and the overall working relationship between the city and the nonprofit. Without the contract, which expired June 30th, the organization would have had fewer dollars to spend on homeless-related services at a time when beds are vanishing and the valley's unhoused population is increasing. The city's talks with Keys, which owns and manages the 13-acre Key campus off Madison Street and 12th Avenue, reached an impasse last month. City officials, including Vice Mayor Ann O'Brien, raised doubts about the nonprofit's ability to manage its finances following reports that it had endured budget deficits in recent years. They voted twice in recent weeks to hold up the expiring contract because they wanted the nonprofit to give the city a non-voting seat on its governing board. Having a seat, they said, would give the city a voice and insight into how Keys manages its resources. Keys leadership, however, refused, arguing that giving the funders a board seat isn't good practice or governance because they could influence decisions. To compromise, Keys recommended opening more lines of communication with the city. The council agreed, approving the $1.5 million contract extension along with a series of caveats. Under the renewed contract, a representative from Phoenix's Office of Homeless Solutions will have a non-voting seat on the charity's finance committee. They can also sit in on some board meetings that are of interest to the city. That representative, along with a council member, will also meet monthly with Keys CEO Amy Schwabenländer and Board of Directors Chairperson Myron Hams. At the end of 2025, the council will discuss whether those terms had led to a better relationship between the city and Keys. If officials determine that it hasn't improved, they can again demand a board seat or cancel the rest of the contract. While Schwabenländer and Hams noted to the council that the last condition sets a subjective standard, they expressed their support for the other three conditions, agreeing that they would help build the relationship. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article titled, Report Released on San Diego Plane Crash That Killed Six. The National Transportation Safety Board released its preliminary report regarding the fatal San Diego plane crash that killed six people, four of whom were a family from Thatcher, Arizona, 1 month after the deadly incident occurred. The crash killed Jeremy Bingham and his three adult sons, Aiden Bingham, Bailey Bingham, and Gavin Bingham, along with the pilot, Landon Baldwin, and his wife, Tori Baldwin. The plane had flown to San Diego from Phoenix the day before and was heading back to Phoenix when the crash occurred. Chaffin Woods, a friend of Jeremy Bingham and a former football coach of Aiden, previously told the Arizona Republic the San Diego trip was part of an excursion the Bingham family often took to create new memories. The plane, a Cessna 414A, took off from San Diego and climbed to 1,600 feet when the air traffic controller instructed Baldwin to make a 180-degree turn to the left, the report said. The plane made a gradual turn as it reached 2,000 feet before it made a steep descent to 200 feet, prompting the air traffic controller to issue a low altitude alert and instruct Baldwin to reach an altitude of 4,000 feet immediately. Baldwin repeated back the air traffic controller's instructions, and the controller asked Baldwin if he needed any assistance and about the nature of the issue he was experiencing, the report said. Baldwin said he was struggling to maintain the plane on a heading and climb. The air traffic controller told Baldwin the nearest airport was 1 mile away and asked if he could see it, to which Baldwin replied that he couldn't, the report said. Baldwin then made a series of erratic maneuvers before making several mayday calls, according to the report. A police helicopter responded to the suspected crash site after receiving a request to search for any signs of a plane crashing into the water, according to the report. The helicopter's pilot said in a post-accident interview that he found an oil slick about 2 miles offshore, the report said. The plane's regular pilot, who was a friend of Baldwin, said he had flown about 50 hours with Baldwin in the Cessna 414A and said 2 days before the crash that Baldwin had flown alone to Springerville, Arizona. The unnamed friend acted as a safety pilot and recalled that Baldwin was used to flying with his hands, the report said. The plane lacked an autopilot and a glass cockpit, the report said. The friend also said Baldwin expressed some nervousness about the busy Southern California airspace, but appeared to be capable during their review of the San Diego departure procedure. The report did not include a suspected cause behind the fatal crash. The plane and the bodies of those on board have not been found as of July 8th. The next article is titled, Agriculture Secretary Promises No Migrant Exemptions. The Trump administration continued to send Americans mixed signals on who is exempt from its massive effort to deport millions of undocumented immigrants. In June, President Donald Trump had vowed to protect migrants from raids at farms, hotels, and restaurants, quickly reversing course after leaders in those industries expressed concerns about worker shortages. "Our farmers are being hurt badly," Trump said in a Truth Social post on June 12th. "You know, they have very good workers. They've worked for them for 20 years. They're not citizens, but they've turned out to be, you know, great." But carve-outs for certain industries were rejected by some voices in the White House, such as Stephen Miller, a deputy White House chief of staff, who is the top architect of the administration's immigration crackdown. A White House official also confirmed the change in direction with USA Today in late June, saying anyone in the United States illegally is at risk of deportation. But Trump, as recently as July 3rd, indicated he wanted to protect farmers who depend on migrant labor, saying, "We'll put the farmers in charge of deportations for migrant farm workers." That prompted a new round of questions from supporters and critics who have been unclear on how to treat migrant workers in certain industries. I can't underscore enough, there will be no amnesty. The mass deportations continue, but in a strategic way, Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins said at a news conference on July 8th. About 42% of farm workers in the United States from 2020 to 2022 lacked legal status, according to the Department of Homeland Security. Trump's critics have been quick to call out the administration for showing a hint of deference to farmers and other industries, saying it could undermine his credibility with supporters. It's obvious Trump wants to provide amnesty to migrant farm and hospitality workers, and he's still workshopping how to pull it off without drawing the ire of his base, former U.S. Representative Justin Amash of Michigan said in a post on X. Conservative activist and author J.J. Carell said in a post on July 4th that he remains a Trump supporter, but that the president is making a huge mistake talking about letting farm and hotel workers off the hook. In a cabinet meeting on July 8th, the president tried to downplay any signals that some migrants would get a pass. He instead asked cabinet members to explain a program that would keep their pledge to boot millions of undocumented immigrants while ensuring farmers have the labor they need. Labor Secretary Lori Chavez de Remer said her agency, for instance, plans to create a new office to answer the need of our farmers and ranchers and producers, but she provided few details. Trump, who signaled the shift on July 3rd during a stop in Iowa, hinted the administration was working on a proposal that would permit some migrants without proper paperwork to keep working on U.S. farms. The next article is titled, U.S. Delivering Some Weapons to Ukraine Again, written by Idris Ali and Phil Stewart. The United States is delivering artillery shells and mobile rocket artillery missiles to Ukraine, two U.S. officials told Reuters on July 9th, days after President Donald Trump's administration halted shipments of some critical weapons to Kyiv. The pause in some weapons shipments last week appears to have been tied to concerns that U.S. military stockpiles might be too low, officials had said. Since then, Trump said he did not know who ordered the pause and that he would send more weapons to Ukraine, primarily defensive ones, to help the war-torn country defend itself against intensifying Russian advances. The officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, said 155mm artillery shells and mobile rocket artillery missiles were now being provided to Ukraine. The officials did not say how many weapons were being sent and whether the shipment was complete. It was also unclear why the latest shipments only included shells and artillery missiles, and whether any decision had been made to resume shipments of other weapons. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on July 8th he ordered an expansion of contacts with the United States to ensure critical deliveries of military supplies, primarily air defense. Trump has said he will consider sending Patriot air defense missiles to Ukraine, but it is unclear when. The shipment paused last week included 30 Patriot missiles, 8,500 155mm artillery shells, more than 250 GMLRSs, and 142 Hellfire air-to-surface missiles. Kyiv has said that more air defense systems are desperately needed to help counter the swarms of drones and missiles Russia has been sending since its invasion in 2022. Russia targeted Ukraine with a record 728 drones overnight. The attack, which follows a series of escalating air assaults on Ukraine in recent weeks, showed the need for biting sanctions on the sources of income Russia uses to finance the war, including on those who buy Russian oil, Zelensky said on Telegram. Meanwhile, Zelensky said on July 9th he had held a substantive conversation with Trump's Ukraine envoy Keith Kellogg in Rome. We discussed weapons supplies and strengthening air defense. Given the increase in Russian attacks, this remains one of our top priorities, Zelensky wrote on the X social media platform. Both men were in Italy ahead of a conference on July 10th and 11th dedicated to Ukraine's recovery and long-term reconstruction following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, now 40 months old. Zelensky said he and Kellogg had discussed at length the proposals to slap tougher sanctions on Moscow, as the Ukrainian leader has long advocated as the best means to persuade the Kremlin to abide by a ceasefire and move towards peace. The next article is entitled, Netanyahu and Trump Continue Ceasefire Talks. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said July 9th his meeting with President Donald Trump focused on freeing hostages held in the Gaza Strip as Israel continued to pound the Palestinian territory amid efforts to reach a ceasefire. Netanyahu said on X that the leaders also discussed the consequences and possibilities of the great victory we achieved over Iran following an aerial war in June in which the United States joined Israeli attacks on the Islamic Republic's nuclear sites. Netanyahu is making his third visit to the United States since Trump took office on January 20th and had earlier told reporters that while he did not think Israel's war in the Palestinian enclave was done, negotiators are certainly working on a ceasefire. Trump met Netanyahu on July 8th for the second time in 2 days to discuss the situation in Gaza, with the president's Middle East envoy indicating that Israel and Hamas were nearing an agreement on a ceasefire deal after 21 months of war. A delegation from Qatar, the host of indirect talks between Israeli negotiators and the Palestinian militant group Hamas, met senior White House officials before Netanyahu's arrival on July 8th, Axios said, citing a source familiar with the details. The White House had no comment. Steve Witkoff, Trump's special envoy to the Middle East, said a number of issues preventing Israel and Hamas from reaching an agreement had decreased from 4 to 1, expressing optimism for a temporary ceasefire deal by the end of the week. Witkoff told reporters at a cabinet meeting that the anticipated agreement would involve a 60-day ceasefire with the release of 10 living and 9 deceased hostages. Netanyahu met with Vice President J.D. Vance before visiting the U.S. Capitol on July 8th and was due back in Congress on July 9th to meet Senate leaders. We have still to finish the job in Gaza, release all our hostages, eliminate and destroy Hamas's military and government capabilities, Netanyahu said on July 8th. In recent weeks, Israel's military has continued to hammer Gaza where a teddy bear lay in the rubble on July 9th at the site of one overnight airstrike in southern Gaza's Khan Yunis. Mohammed Shaban, a Palestinian grandmother mourning the deaths of three of her grandchildren in the attack, questioned the timing of a proposed ceasefire. In Gaza City, people removed debris after another overnight airstrike, searching through a three-story house for survivors, but to no avail. The Gaza conflict began with a Hamas attack on southern Israel in October 2023 that killed approximately 1,200 people and saw 251 hostages taken, according to Israeli figures. Around 50 hostages remain in Gaza, and 20 are believed to be alive. Israel's retaliatory war has killed over 57,000 Palestinians, Gaza's health ministry says, and reduced much of Gaza to rubble. Hamas has long demanded an end to the war before it would free the remaining hostages. Israel has insisted it would not agree to stop fighting until all hostages are released and Hamas dismantled. The next article is titled, Trump Imposes 50% Levies on Brazil, written by Kanishka Singh and Ricardo Brito. President Donald Trump said on July 9th, the United States would impose a 50% tariff on all imports from Brazil after a spat this week with his Brazilian counterpart, who called him an unwanted emperor. Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva fired back on July 9th, saying new tariffs would be met with reciprocal measures. In a letter, Trump linked the tariffs to Brazil's treatment of former President Jair Bolsonaro, who is on trial over charges of plotting a coup to stop Lula from taking office in 2023. The levies were imposed due, in part, to Brazil's insidious attacks on free elections and the fundamental free speech rights of Americans, the letter said. Brazil's real currency added to earlier losses to fall over 2% against the dollar after the announcement, and companies such as plane maker Embraer and oil major Petrobras also suffered setbacks in the stock market. Lula, his vice president, finance minister, and others held an emergency meeting in Brasilia on July 9th to discuss the new levies. In a lengthy post to social media after the meeting, Lula said Trump's accusations that trade between the two countries was unfair to the United States were false, stressing the United States runs a trade surplus against Brazil. Sovereignty, respect, and the unwavering defense of the interests of the Brazilian people are the values that guide our relationship with the world, Lula wrote. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.